or omissions reported during this program. This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by AFGE Air Force Local 1101 President Dave Owens and Media Consortium Director Tracy Van Slyke. But first, hear Jason Fornicola's interview with Campaign for America's Future fellow Dave Johnson.
We've been joined by Dave Johnson, fellow for the Campaign for America's Future. The campaign, of course, is the sponsor of the America's Future Now. Dave, welcome to the conference.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing here today, what you have going on at the conference. Give us a little preview.
Well, the conference is discussing the economic situation, mostly the economic situation, because we're in the economic crisis. And the world needs to come up with a third economic paradigm. You know, there was the agricultural revolution, then the industrial revolution, and now we're having this internet globalization, green everything else revolution happening. It's a big transformation, and this conference is trying to help guide progressive legislation, progressive policy, and progressive ideas for how we approach this new economic paradigm.
What are some of the foundation building blocks for progressive economics, and what does that start with, and what does it build up to?
Well, I think a core progressive value is to say that we're all in this together, rather than everyone out for themselves. The conservative paradigm is much more of a you're on your own, dog eat dog, everyone out for themselves. And progressives look for a more practical approach, actually, a more pragmatic approach that looks at what has actually worked in history and the lessons we've learned throughout history. And the lessons we've learned is that if you don't have people sharing the pie, then you end up with trouble, not to mention that we care about people suffering, people being able to get by, people being able to make it. So I'd say that's a core foundation. We're in this together.
And what would you say to people who may say something along the lines of, well, in terms of sharing the pie, you know, who gets how much, and what about the element of competition in the marketplace and things like that?
Competition is very successful at incentivizing innovations in consumer products. But there's also basic rights. I mean, you don't have a successful society when people are competing for food, competing to have water or clean air to breathe, or competing for health care. So competition has an incentivizing element, but we're not all homo economists, as they say. We're not just economic beings. And in fact, that branch of economics is even starting grudgingly to acknowledge that this economic behavior that they say everybody ought to follow actually hasn't been working very well, even for them.
Now, other than we're all in this together, what else are some building blocks to progressive economics that you're looking at?
Well, one thing I think the world is learning right now is that you need to invest before you can reap the rewards. I've been writing about a series called The Reagan Revolution, Home to Roost, and when we started cutting out government in the 80s, one of the things we stopped doing was investing in our own infrastructure. We not only stopped modernizing our infrastructure, we started to defer maintenance of our infrastructure. And we're starting to see the results now. This can take time. I mean, we've been living off of the great infrastructure that America built up between the New Deal in the 60s and into the 70s. We've been living off of that, and it's starting to crumble. We could see it all around us. We're using 19th century rail systems, and China's building modern high-speed rail systems connecting all of their major cities, and the investment from that, not just in their domestic transportation, but now that we're actually starting to experiment with high-speed rail, they're coming over here and bidding on the projects because they've developed the technology that we've fallen behind on. Or the green economy. it was obvious to the world that we were going to need to transform to what's called a green economy. Other countries were investing in learning how to optimize the technology of windmills, for example. And so now that we're starting to build giant wind farms here to meet some of our energy needs, countries like China, European countries, even India, are coming here to sell us the technology with it because they're so far ahead, because they were investing in that technology through the entire previous administration, where they were solely focused on developing oil as a energy source.
And by investing in infrastructure, we would certainly obviously improve ourselves within our own country, but also we would be creating jobs, which is my next point. And you know, where are we going with the jobs crisis in America? That seems to be probably the biggest thing we're facing.
It's the biggest thing we're facing, and yet, you know, I fly in here to D.C., and I find myself in this strange bubble where they think jobs aren't, you know, jobs are, that's last year's issue or something. The Congress is, like, not thinking about creating jobs. The whole environment here seems to have shifted. It's the strangest thing, and yet where I come from, Silicon Valley, we've got more than 12% unemployment. Silicon Valley. The country is in a jobs crisis. In 1983, 10% unemployment was like a national emergency, and here we are. Oh, it's just 10%. You know, the economy's turning around, I guess. We don't need to worry about it. Think about this. Just one small investment in improving our infrastructure would be to they call it cash for caulkers, where you retrofit buildings to be more energy efficient, government buildings, business commercial buildings, and homes with energy efficient windows, even just, you know, the manual labor of sealing up cracks that let a wind in or cold in or heat out across the whole country. If we did that with all of our buildings, that would in the process, the investment in that would create an enormous number of jobs. But the real benefit, the payoff from just making our buildings energy efficient, how much less natural gas, how much less oil, how much less coal would we need to use for electricity forever after, the amount per month that we spend on energy bills would drop considerably. So it would certainly pay for itself, but the thinking for that kind of investment just somehow has just gone out the window. I don't understand it. I'm sorry, I'm flummoxed. Go ahead and ask me a question.
It seems like people get very concerned about the deficit.
Yes.
And how do you tie in the deficit to creating jobs? And what is there a priority? Should there be a priority? I know I've heard a lot recently about, you know, hey, let's worry about the deficit a little later. We can take care of that. Let's get people back to work first.
Well, it's more than that. It's that the only way to really address the deficit is to do the kind of investment that later on will bring the returns that I've been talking about. Okay, so let's say they want to cut the deficit, so they drop investment. I have seen over the years so many companies, you know, they'll drop doing research and development to bring a quarterly return, but then they're cutting out their long-term survival. You have to invest. You have to maintain infrastructure to reap the economic rewards of a prosperous economy. You have to do it. And they're trying to say, let's divest, almost. Like, let's sell off the things that bring us that return later. The only way to grow the revenue the only way, first, the investment cuts what you have to spend. Second, the investment brings a higher return. The only way to cut that deficit the long term is to do that investment now. It's like people who don't want to save for retirement. You know, you have a little more money now if you don't put it in the bank. That's the kind of thinking that seems to be happening right now. Let's save $1 billion this year off of the deficit. And what you're doing is you're adding maybe $500 million to the deficit every single year forever after as a result.
How much of that thinking is political thinking in terms of being able to say, well, we reduced this or we did something here as a talking point when it comes time to get reelected for politicians? Do you think that plays into it?
Yeah, it gives you simple talking points, yeah. I think, to say, well, I was able to cut out $30 billion from the deficit by cutting all the old people off of Social Security or by cutting all the older workers off of having COBRA.
for a politician who's not going to be in office in any capacity in 30 years,
right.
What's the incentive to do that, or is it something else?
No, it's you're right. There's with the public not as well informed, perhaps, or something. I have to think about this for a second. But you're right. The public is right now responding to short-term things. We're thinking, as George Lakoff would say, we think about the national government the way we think about our family. And people are saying, well, my family has to cut back right now, so should the government. But in fact, that's exactly when government should be investing. People call it deficit spending. I call it investing.
Are you finding here at the conference that a lot of ideas are coming up on how to sort of right the ship and get things going in the right direction on these issues?
Well, the conference just started. I heard a very good debate just now with Darcy Berner, and sorry, the other guy's name slips my mind, but that's just the beginning. It's the next few days, especially tomorrow. There's a number of jobs and Wall Street discussions. And in fact, by the way, if you're listening to this before the conference finishes, you can see the conference streamed video at ourfuture.org/now.
One of the things that we talked about the last time we linked up with you here on the show was the situation in China and what's going on there and some of the trade issues. Can you give us an update on that?
Well, they just finished the strategic and economic dialogue. One of the biggest issues has been the Chinese currency. The government of China is doing currency manipulation to hold their currency at a much lower value than the market value would be. And as a result of that, they have an advantage coming out the gate before any other advantages they're getting of up to 40% in a pricing advantage, which makes it very, very difficult for the world to compete. By pegging their currency at this undervalued rate, by pegging it then to the dollar, they maintain a constant advantage to get new business. Now, that's costing them in many ways, but they're seeing the longer-term advantage of gathering up all of the manufacturing business that they're gathering. Now, that hasn't been addressed. It was supposed to be addressed in April. The Treasury Department was supposed to make a formal declaration, and to deal with that, they put off the declaration. They discussed it, I understand, at the dialogue recently. They're taking it up with the G20, but of course it's a hugely complicated relationship where we need China's help with North Korea, we need their help with Iran, other trade-offs like that. And so they're finding it right now, they're working with the Chinese government to get votes to, I mean, these are also critical issues, of course, but the problem is that it's costing us and in the longer term costing China to maintain this currency imbalance. Now, I want to add, China's government is being smart. I'm not heavily criticizing China on this. They're trying to take care of their people. But they're doing classic mercantilist protectionist moves here. And our government is responding with a free trade posture that then allows them to take advantage of that and gain these pricing advantages and other advantages. And it's costing us. And as I said, though, it does cost China in the long term.
Dave Johnson, fellow Campaign for America's Future. Dave, as always, thank you very much for your time and being here.
Thank you so much.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Purchasing Power has a hassle-free way for you to buy computers, electronics, and home appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required and no credit checks. You can get an HP desktop computer with 18.5-inch LCD monitor and 320-gig hard drive for just $42 bi-weekly. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com. AFGE members are eligible for a 6% members-only discount. Sales tax may apply.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I've been joined by Dave Owens, president of AFGE Local 1101. Welcome to Inside Government.
Hi, good to be here.
So where is Local 1101?
Well, we're far north in Alaska. If you look at Anchorage, Alaska, we're right outside the base, the Ellsworth Air Force Base. We're about a mile from Anchorage, Alaska. It's southeast, and it's a beautiful day, rainy day in Alaska today.
And what's going on up there?
What's going on right now is a few months ago, myself and a union brother from Travis Air Force Base, John Santor, we discovered that the Air Force had what's called a food transformation initiative going on. This food transformation initiative was to combine all food services on the base, including the dining hall, cooks, anybody who did food services, the bowling alley, golf course, you name it, under one contractor. This was a pilot program, of course. They said at six Air Force bases, but within 2 years, the Air Force wanted to change and have this thing in place at every single Air Force base. They want one contractor to replace all the non-appropriated fund NAF employees, appropriated fund people, and have him doing all the food service. This is huge. This would be thousands of people losing their job. And we put in a protest with the GAO basically to say, look, they didn't do an A76 study. They did not do a cost analysis. They didn't do anything. So John Santry, since he does represent the NAF employees, was an interested party change we got in 2008 legislation. So that allowed us to file a protest. And we both worked together in this in concert. And we're working together to fight it. Now, the big issue about this thing is bundling. The Air Force seems to think that if they can bundle these contracts and do all the NAF issues like this, they said that NAF employees are not government employees. And that was, and we do not agree, and our people in the AFG do not agree either. That's actually doing a direct conversion is a violation of Title 10 U.S.C. 2461 and House Bill 2647, which basically said you have to do an A76 study before you can do a direct conversion. And the Air Force seems to think that they can circumvent this by using the non-appropriated fund vehicle.
Now, you know, I know coming from a military family, I mean, for decades now, these positions like at the commissaries and things like that, I mean, these have been run this way for a long time by the military with the non-appropriated fund folks, and nobody seems to complain. I mean, what kinds of things? Let's go through that. What types of things do these folks do?
What happens is I have cooks, wage grade sixes and wage grade eight cooks, who work at the dining facility. The main dining facility and installation is for the meal card holders, the single airmen and the NCOs who live in the dorms, who do not get a food allowance so they don't buy their own food. They get most of their food, their three squares a day, at the dining facility. And the funny thing about this, the Air Force is using this saying it's going to be better for the airmen, it's going to be better for them, they're going to get more selection of food. Well, it's understandable why, because these two bases, my base, they have an award they call the Hennessy Award, and that's the best dining facility in the Air Force. Our base won it for 3 years. In the last 10 years, our base won it 3 years. And the Travis Air Force Base, another base being contracted out, they won the Hennessy Award as the best dining facility for 3 years, too, in the last decade. So the two bases, they're contracting out the best dining facility in the Air Force. And we are trying to understand why they're doing that. It doesn't make any sense. If this is the best dining facility in the Air Force, obviously they're getting fantastic service. So, and also, you're talking a lot of people all throughout the installation who do it. They're just little cooks. They're people servicing individuals. They're not making a lot of money. Some of the NAF people only make from $10 to $15 an hour. So where's the cost savings to the taxpayer? There is none. They haven't done a cost analysis, which is required in the A76 process. They have not provided that to GAO or to us. So it's going to cost the taxpayer a lot more money, and unfortunately when they contract out, these employees will lose a lot of benefits, and guess what? I bet their wages ain't going to go up either.
And let's talk about who some of the employees are. I mean, does the veterans preference apply to these folks?
NAF employees, no. It does apply. Veterans preference does apply to the employees and appropriated upon the cooks and stuff. But the real issue about this, there's no guarantee that when the contractor takes over at every single basis that he will hire back the NAF people. So I actually got a little lady. She works over in Child Development Center. She's been there for 4 years. And obviously I'm not using her name for, you know, I'm trying to protect her because she's a little scared. She's been a she was in the Army for 14 years. She's been a NAF employee for 4 years. And she has a daughter who is currently serving in the Air Force. She didn't even know that there was a chance she could lose her job. They didn't even brief her about that. They didn't tell her. And she only makes about $15 an hour. And she's been a civil service for, she's been a NAF employee for 4 years. And she's like, what am I going to do? Are they going to hire me? And she said, doesn't have any protection. And she's like a single parent, too.
Whose idea was this? I mean, where did this come from?
That's what we don't understand. The Food Initiative, the Food Transformation Initiative, had they been pushing this thing around since 2008, but they never came to the union. They never notified the union. They never let the union know about what was going on. And we found out this through nothing other than they put an article in the Travis, I think it's Tailwind, that's the article in the newspaper they put out at Travis Air Force Base. It was our first knowledge of this, where Don Sanchez became aware of it. And one thing I find insulting, they're talking about how great this dining facility is going to be, how good it's going to be for the airmen, and they have a picture on the same page of one of the service people. She's smiling. She's one of the people who works there, I obviously think. But I'm wondering if the Air Force PR, Public Affairs, had the guts to tell this lady, oh, by the way, you're smiling for this article. We're going to actually contract out your job. It's nothing other than smoke and mirrors. It's nothing other than the same old game. Oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be great. But by the way, we're contracting you out. You're losing your job. And the contractor costs will probably triple what it used to cost to operate the funds.
You know, this was the kind of thing that was seemingly the way the military was run 5, 6, 7 years ago. But today, I mean, with all the legislation, with the intent of Congress that we're going to be insourcing, we're bringing jobs back in, this goes against the whole intent of what we've been told is the position of the Obama administration. Is anybody higher up meeting with the union and talking about this and taking this on?
John Gage himself has sent a letter to the Secretary of Air Force asking to meet. No one has met with us yet. We actually have put several issues before them. They will not meet with us, and they will have not talked to us. They have not provided any information to us or to GO. The Air Force seems to think if they just wait us out, that they can get through it and then convert. And this is conversion October 1st of this year. This is actually, and they are saying that the same issues of laws and protection we have got through, which actually protect the taxpayer, because there's nothing other than a cost analysis to say if this is cheaper, they have to do a cost comparison, which says that the contractor is doing it cheaper. They're saying that the NAF employees, and let me tell you something, NAF employees are a lot of people on the bases. There's 400 on my base. John Sentry on Travis has over 500. These people do a lot of different functions, from billeting to food service. They work at the golf courses. They work at the ski resorts. Now, what I'm thinking, in my own opinion, is the contractors have been stiffed because we've been able to put legislation which is fair, which gives a cost comparison to show that the federal employees can actually do the job cheaper for the taxpayer and a heck of a lot better. So they're looking, oh, we can go this way, and we can bundle these contracts so we can one contractor can get this big chunk. I think you'll probably see later them coming after the NAF as far as in billeting, who does all the cleans the bed, cleans the area for the temporary housing for the military members, to the golf courses, to everything. I think it's nothing other than them trying to find a way to circumvent the statute, which we think, in our opinion, does include NAF employees.
And certainly the NAF employees who are there, I mean, they become part of the base. They're integrated into the base. Most of these folks have been there for a very long time, and it gives the Department of Defense some control over what's going on a base. Just imagine if a private contractor is in charge of who these people are hiring and firing, and you know they decide who comes on and off a base. I mean, I think there's a security risk with some of this.
Well, you're talking, and this is something that they haven't quite talked about, and let me tell you. They are going to hire contract people that don't have the same standards or security clearances required, especially by certain cooks and stuff I have that appropriated fund that work in a dining facility. Now, God forbid this would happen, but just think of what would happen if you had someone who had some issue with America, became a ability to control the food that are given out to our airmen in the dining hall that are like hundreds and hundreds, thousands of meals given out a month, and that individual had an ability to put something in with the food. Now, my non-appropriated fund guy, cooks have been there. Some of them have. One of them has been there for 27 years. The contractor is actually going to give tactical direction to them on how to do the food service. So the contractor is going to be directing them. They'll say their supervisors, military supervisors, and management will still be able to supervise them. Supervise them on what? If the supervisor is giving direction to these cooks and tell you, you cook the food this way, you put this in. But again, I'm a little worried when you got one individual providing all food services on every single Air Force base. it makes you wonder, are they thinking about the security issues? Because it's food, and food, you could put poison in real easy.
So we've got a national security issue. We've got no cost analysis that's been done. There's no indication that we're saving any money. I mean, this just sounds very, very strange. And then they're refusing to meet with AFGE on this?
Yes, they are.
So what's next? Where are we in terms of the timeline on this?
What's going to happen right now is GEO has got to issue a decision on our protest by August. And the decision, if it's denied, if our protest is dismissed, and the Air Force is allowed to go forward with the pilot program. Now, we have been able to get some legislation in the House Armed Services Committee, which limits this just to 6 bases. They also are requiring that the Comptroller General report back to the Armed Services Committee on what's happening. They basically want to know a comprehensive report saying, has the initiative changed, how many people have been impacted, some of the cost processes, and has the food service actually improved quality for the airmen, and what the impact has been on the NAF and appropriated fund employees. That's actually a big win, but unfortunately it hasn't stopped the pilot program. But now we'll have some actual information provided to the House Armed Services Committee to prove that this, some of these things that union's contention is it's not better, it's not saving money, it's having a major impact on the employees. So that's one issue we have, but it's not going to save the 6 bases. The only thing I can think to do is we need the Secretary of Air Force to stop this thing until we get some hard information to prove it's not going to cost money, it's not, to give some transparency as the Obama administration wants to have in government to stop it. He can stop it until we get this information, and then we can go forward and do what they're required by the law is to do an A76 study. But if we don't get that done, by October 1st, they're going to start the initiative.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Dave Owens, the president of AFGE Local 1101 up in Alaska. So they're talking about contracting out some of your folks up there, the dining services. How are the people reacting to this that actually do the job?
Well, when I took some information over on the actual statement of work, which is the draft, and we actually got some information from the Air Force Litigation Group that talked about how they would be giving technical direction to the employees. When I went and showed that to some of my wage grade cooks who take great pride in doing a great job for the airmen, they really enjoy, as I talked about earlier, they've won the award, the best dining facility in the Air Force 3 times this last 10 years. Why do I have to take direction from a contractor? How much is that going to entail? How's that going to impact me? If I don't follow his direction, who's going to do disparate action against me? They were very worried. They had been told something totally different by the Food Transformation Initiative people that were there April 29th. Oh, it's not going to have any impact on me. It's not going to hurt you. But when they ask questions, you should have heard how vague it was. Like one Mr. Davis, one of the cooks there, he's a wage grade 8, asked, and he's retired military, but he's been working civil service quite a while. He asked a very pointed question, said, well, how is this going to impact my work? Well, don't worry, it'll be better. How's it going to be better? Who's going to be my boss? Wouldn't answer that either. this was the people from the Food Transportation Initiative saying this. He said, well, what's going to happen after the pilot program in 2 years? The guy said, well, we don't know. I haven't got a crystal ball. These guys were like giving, it's like a song and dance. I thought I was listening to a used car salesman giving me a song and dance how great this lemon is. But don't worry, we'll talk to you later about it. And these people are getting very worried because they're listening to this stuff, and I provide documentation to prove what they're saying is not true, and they're shocked. And now the NAF people are terrified. They are so afraid to even say anything because they're afraid they're going to be fired. They're afraid that the Air Force will actually, at Travis Air Force Base, they put a statement out to all the NAF employees, do not talk to the union. And the union represents them there. I'm busy organizing the NAV here on this base.
And my understanding, though, is that people are so upset there was an informational picket line held recently.
Yes, we actually, my local organized an informational picket on the 28th outside the gate. We had union activists here from the 11th District competing and having a training. So my local, we have actually had buses pick up people at the training center, bring them to the front gate. We actually were lucky enough to have John Gage and our National Secretary Treasurer join us on the picket line and walk the line. I had quite a few of my union brothers from the local show up, including some of the cooks who are going to be impacted. I did invite the NAF employees, but unfortunately they're very afraid right now, obviously because the union doesn't have them under the union protection. So they didn't show up, but we did have quite a big a media event showed up. We had Associated Press show up. We were able to articulate and tell the media what's really happening. That's what an informational picket is for, is to say, look, this is what they are doing. The Air Force was invited by the media to give a comment. They refused to show up.
And where are we going from here, I guess? My understanding, as you mentioned, the Government Accountability Office is going to conduct a cost analysis study, but is that going to be after the fact?
After the fact.
Nobody's studying whether this is going to save any money or even if there's a reason to do this.
No. They're actually, I don't think, in my own opinion, that the Air Force thought they had this thing a done deal. And I'll tell you the thing I find insulting. They're very arrogant sometimes. They think that they can do whatever they want to. These are some of the people left over that have been for the last 10 years. Their answer has always been, let's contract out, let's contract out. It's never let's use the initiative to try to improve the food service by working with the existing employees or working with the union and saying, we can do this and this. What do you think about this? A perfect example, they could include everybody going to the dining facility. If they said they're not getting enough usage, they can say, well, we'll do a surcharge. All the civilians and everybody else can come eat there. They don't do that. They don't use initiatives to try to find ways to improve the existing conditions with employees. Their big answer and their agenda has always been to contract out federal employees to get rid of us. So I think the biggest thing we have to do, if we can't stop this thing, and the legislation, GAO says the legislation does not apply, we need to get back in there. We need to get with our congressional members and our senators, and we need to clarify the language in the legislation to make it very clear that NAF employees are under the same statute, and that's only going to give it cheaper for the taxpayer because it's going to show that they can still do the job better and cheaper. So if we have to, that's the last case, the worst case scenario. We'll have to go to Congress and clarify the language.
Have you had some support from Congress? Have you talked to some members and staffs?
Yes, I've had some support from my congressional members, mainly Senator Bagage from Alaska. He was instrumental, and his staff was able to get some language on similar to the House one on the Armed Services Committee, and I do appreciate that. We were also able to get the House Armed Services Committee working with us on this, but mainly the main help I've got from this is from Senator Bagage.
And with the informational picket line, what was the reaction to that by the folks that work on the base?
Big smiles. I went over to a couple of the NAF areas, and they were coming up to me quietly. This is, of course, during their breaks. And they said, thank you for fighting for us. They were like, these are low-wage people. These are mostly women and minorities. And even a lot of them that don't have some limited English skills, they're American citizens. They're here legally. But they're very afraid, and these individuals have never really had protection, and they're scared. But they said, the more and more ladies said, I really want to thank you for fighting for me. Thank you. That was a reaction.
And do you think there's going to be a way to get some of those folks to maybe bring to bear, even if it's just letters, phone calls, emails to members of Congress to kind of light a fire?
Working it already. What we plan to do is have some more lunch and learns, because as I told you, I'm organizing the NAF. We're also profiling all the employees that are being impacted. Like I told you about the one lady in the child care area. She's 57 years old, single parent. She's widowed, actually. Her daughter's in the Air Force. And what we're trying to do is profiling all the individuals that are going to be impacted by this. Our national president, John Gage, has assured us he'll let that information go forward to the Secretary of Defense, Undersecretary of Defense, so maybe we can actually put a little bit of faces to these numbers. We're also going to have them do as much as possible, if they're willing, letters to Congress, and hopefully do emails also to say, look, this is happening to me. What are you going to do to help me? The same thing's happening at Travis and the other Air Force bases. We're trying to get other local presidents involved to do the same thing.
And are you finding that you're getting a lot of support? I mean, you've mentioned that President Gage came out there, National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox came out there. Are other unions in the Alaska area supporting you on this too?
We're getting the AFL-CIO, state AFL-CIO, to help us with this. We've notified the Central Labor Council, which I sit on there. They're going to be giving some assistance also, putting some pressure on congressional members. We work in concert with our other unions up here, and they're especially also the services union, which represents a lot of the same people in the private sector that we're talking about to do the same job here. So we are getting support from them already.
And I know sometimes when people think about government service, they think it's very much inside the D.C. Beltway. I mean, you guys are almost as far away as you could possibly be from the D.C. Beltway. Are you finding with the members from the informational picket, like you mentioned with the woman, the folks out there are seeing that the union cares about people, you know, no matter how far away from the D.C. Beltway you are?
Yes. My people and the people we talk to, they understand. Actually, a lot of them don't even think of AFGE as being in D.C. because the AFGE is here. My union is AFGE, Local 1101. That's the local president. I see him all the time. They don't even think about it as being in D.C. Most people at the local, we're local. They see me, they hear me, they come talk to me. They think of their union as being here on Elmhurst Air Force Base.
And
that's what they think.
Where are some of the other Air Force bases this is going on so that people know?
We're going to have it in several Air Force bases. There's going to be it's going to be in Florida, Patrick Air Force Base, MacDill Air Force Base. There's one in Washington State, Fairchild Air Force Base. One in California, Travis Air Force Base. One in Arkansas, Little Rock Air Force Base. And, of course, Elmhurst.
So people need to know, this isn't just a unique thing in Alaska. This is happening all over the country.
Yes, this is the 6 Air Force bases on the pilot program. After that, they want to start this thing at every single Air Force base. And let me tell you something. The way I look at these guys, I wouldn't be a bit surprised. You start hearing the same thing in the Army and the same thing in the Marines and the same thing in the Navy.
And switch issues a little bit. In addition to the privatization fight, you're also engaged in something called joint basing. Can you tell us
a little
about that?
What's happening is, under the BRAC, certain bases were closed and certain bases were doing what's called a joint base. Elmhurst and Fort Ridge, which is represented by 1712, another AFG local, we actually are doing a joint base initiative, which meant we're becoming what's called J-Bear. J-Bear is being set up July the 30th. Now, J-Bear will be basically a combination of Fort Ridge and Elmhurst Air Force Base combined, and they'll call it 673rd, and it'll be J-Bear. Then what the joint basing means that we're going to probably have to do, so a lot of Army employers are being converted over to Air Force employees. We were meeting yesterday with the Federal Labor Relations Authority because we're going to be doing a pre-petition hearing because that local and myself are in agreement, and also the agency reps, that we will do a pre-petition hearing to the authority for clarification of our cert to include whether or not we have to have an election, which shouldn't be any problem, that my local will continue to represent the Air Force employees, including the Army employees that are being converted to Air Force employees. The other one, 1712, is not going away. It'll have a smaller contingent, and that'll be just a core group of Army employees who are doing representation, mainly nothing more than they do garrison support, like they work on the Humvees, mechanics that do the Humvees, or direct support to the military. The other ones, basically doing base support, will be converted to Air Force employees. The initiative is working smoothly, but as usual, the management doesn't provide information to the union. I mean, as far as what's happening with the base realignment and stuff like that, we've already demanded a bargain, telling them if they're having an impact on employees, the union will be able to negotiate. And it's so funny because the authority was telling the agency that during the interim process, we maybe actually don't have to do an election, but during the interim, they may have to carry 2 contracts around with them. They'll have to identify whether they're an Army employee or an ex-Army employee. That means that they'll be covered by the old contract for Fort Ridge. And they were looking so confused, you wouldn't believe it. I love managers sometimes.
Now, the folks at Fort Richard, are they AFG employees?
They are AFG also. The local and me are in total agreement. AFG locals, we don't get in a fight. We'll work this out. But the main issue is clarification of my cert, so it's very clear of who I'm going to be representing and the transfer of employees over from Army to Air Force.
And as we come down to our last 30 seconds, how did you get involved in AFGE?
I became a union steward in 87. And within 6 months, I was then initiated into a chief steward. And from there, I went to vice president. I was like, I remember the conversation with my president at the time, Don Cole. He says, you want to be a steward? You're pretty good. I says, what's a steward do? And I became involved because I just wanted to become more active in my union. I've been a member for a long time. And it was amazing. Within 6 months, I was a chief steward taking care of hundreds of cases. I'm like, what did I get myself into? Little did I know what was coming.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Are you an AFGE member who loves the great outdoors? Then the AFGE Union Sportsmen's Alliance benefit is perfect for you. Whether it's fins, furs, or feathers that calls you, the Union Sportsmen's Alliance has you covered. This unique benefit is a community of hunters and fishermen who share the Union Brotherhood. That's right, an exclusive hunting and fishing club by and for Union members, retirees, and their families. Your $25 membership gets you money-saving discounts on great outdoor gear and services, a free MyTopo.com online mapping subscription, a 1-year subscription to a top outdoor magazine, and a $25 gift certificate for Beretta field gear. You'll also receive a subscription to the Union Sportsman's Journal. To learn more about this exciting benefit, please visit the member benefits page at afge.org or call us at 877-872-2211. That's 877-872-2211. Join today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Tracy Van Slyke, the author of Beyond the Echo Chamber, Reshaping Politics Through Networked Progressive Media, and also the director of the Media Consortium. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the Media Consortium first. What is that?
So the Media Consortium, a very vague name for a very powerful group, is a network of a lot of the major progressive media outlets in the country, ranging from The Nation to Alternet to Mother Jones to Free Speech TV, Feministing, blogs, radio, television, movies, what have you, all working together to raise the impact of progressive media on politics and public discourse, as well as working together to evolve for a 21st century media environment to make sure we have quality journalism and media.
A lot of folks say that there really isn't sort of a left of center media. Everybody focuses on, some of the more right wing media outlets. How long has this been around and how is it coming together?
So the Media Consortium itself has been around for about 5 years. You know, there is this right wing noise machine, this sort of top down, vertical, very coordinated right wing media infrastructure. The power of the progressive media has been around for many, many years, but in terms of coordination and working together, has really started over the last couple years.
And tell me a little about the book, Beyond the Echo Chamber. What's it about?
So Beyond the Echo Chamber, so we all know the echo chamber, right? The echo chamber is where you're hearing the same messaging or talking points or stories, often coming from a lot of different places, Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and what have you. And those stories are decided upon by sort of the elites in the media system. Well, when we talk about Beyond the Echo Chamber, we talk about how independent media and everyday citizens can help drive stories through coordination and new technology, new media, into the mainstream conversation, sort of bypass those elites.
And how's that been working? Because I know it does seem like anybody with a computer almost could have their own, internet radio show. There's thousands of blogs out there. How does it get coordinated in a way that the message gets out?
Well, yes, anyone can have a show, but the power is in the network. And what we're talking about is sort of how media has been driven and the power of progressive media has been driven in this networked powered media environment, where it's the connections you have with your audience, with your community, with your fellow media outlets that can help drive that story. So For example, we have a great story in there about Talking Points Memo, one of, you know, sort of the leading liberal websites, news websites in the country, and how they worked with their audiences to really uncover and drive the story about, you know, all the U.S. attorneys that were fired a couple years ago. Well, Talking Points Memo was really the organization, while the mainstream media ignored it, that connected all the dots, and they used and worked with their audiences around the community to connect those dots, to do that reporting and drive it into the mainstream so that the mainstream could no longer ignore the story. And in the end, U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez had to resign.
Do you think that with Air America going off the air functionally, has that left a real void for messaging from the left of center groups?
I don't think so. I mean, Air America was an amazing experience in a lot of ways for people. Obviously, it helped the dawn of Rachel Maddow and Senator Al Franken and so forth. So I think in that self, it was a success. And I think it was also a model for lessons learned and about both success and failure. And the blogosphere is a huge opportunity for both messaging as well as reporting, analysis, and advocacy. We've seen the evolution of the blogosphere in a lot of ways. We talk about Fire Dog Lake in the book and how they've combined reporting, analysis, and grassroots advocacy into really driving political change. And that's because they've built up a relationship with their audience and transparency and in what they're talking about, and their audience trusts them, and that helps those audiences take action when Fire Dog Lake recommends it.
It does seem interesting that when people want to just get the facts, as you say, in reporting on things, there's obviously the perceived right-wing media that's out there, and then the sort of mainstream media that's, you know, traditionally been sort of down the center is almost looked at as being left-wing because they don't take a right-wing stance. Does that kind of crowd out the media on the left?
Well, I mean, the right-wing has really perfected the whole notion of this, like, liberal media conspiracy over the last 30 years. So we talk in the book about that they have these attack dogs of the right that always goes after the mainstream media. It's been going after them for years, so they feel, you know, a lot more afraid of, you know, and if the mainstream media is questioning people in power and is lifting up voices from everyday people, that's not liberal or right wing. That's actually talking about the stories and the reporting that everyday people want to hear. So it is a, you know, it's a dangerous move that the right wing is making, but I think the progressives have always stuck true to actually doing, combining amazing reporting skills, journalism, with trust and in relationships with their audience. And I think the key is figuring out, as we talk about in the book, how to do that, these strategies to really break through the mainstream media system to have an impact.
And do you find as trying to coordinate media groups, and particularly I'm thinking of so many bloggers out there, I guess it's, and really it's true on the left and the right in a way, is it sort of like herding cats? I mean, you're trying to get everybody
sometimes
to go in one direction, but, you know, everybody's independent.
See, yeah. So here's the deal, is like, we do not want to create a structure, whether, and we talk about both in the book, Beyond the Echo Chamber, and in my work through the Media Consortium, we're not trying to create the same model of the right wing, like the same noise machine that's working in tandem with each other. We're progressives. We believe in democracy and diversity and debate, sometimes way too much. But what we're trying to create is a system of coordination, like putting puzzle pieces together. So when the right moment is in play, we can lock together. But that doesn't mean that we're always in the same, you know, lockstep together. So through the Media Consortium, we work on a lot of different projects to help raise out the impact of our members, help work on different projects to help them evolve in this new media environment in terms of business models and editorial collaboration. But it's never about trying to get everyone on the same message. Other people may work on that, and that's really important, but that's not the fundamentals of journalism.
One of the problems, it seems, for a lot of folks doing media work on the left is funding, obviously.
Yeah.
And we see that with the Air America example we were talking about. You know, if you're out there for, you know, large corporations, obviously funding is less of a problem, so it's easier to get that message out. When you're talking about, say, anti-poverty issues, or you're talking about workers' rights, those don't tend to be things that people put tremendous amounts of money into. How does that funding work, and is there competition on the left for a limited source of funding?
So, in terms of media itself, you know, historically the right has put a lot more, while they have sort of less money that they put into sort of messaging right-wing media, they pour a lot more into sort of general operations for right-wing media, ranging from messaging to actual their media products themselves. And that's a combination of foundations and corporations that are supporting this stuff. On the left, in terms of media, there's a lot more money for media in general, but or a lot more money for sort of liberal causes, social justice causes, but it's less of it goes straight into media itself. It's really interesting because a lot of funders sort of have been considering media as sort of this black hole. They don't understand it. They don't understand the impact of it, which is part of the reason we wrote the book Beyond the Echo Chamber, to show what's been the impact of progressive media. But in the last couple of years, this sort of this crisis in journalism has, you know, that conversation has been going on. Funders have been trying to figure out how to fund journalism and media in general, ranging from media policy, which is the basic infrastructure for journalism, to journalism itself, to progressive media. So there's a lot of things changing. And so, yeah, there's competition, but we have to sort of educate funders of all, from small donors to big, to really invest in journalism and quality progressive media over long term if we want to change the direction of this country and deepen progressive causes.
And do you think by that taking hold both on the left and the right in a way that the major media, and I'm thinking particularly about print media and newspapers, I constantly see everywhere, you know, the death of the print media.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if that breaks down, that there's no sort of fair arbiter in the middle, what's going to be the future of journalism?
Okay, so first of all, I'm very sick of this death of journalism argument. Journalism is not dying. In fact, it's flourishing. It's the business models behind journalism that are going through this major transition. And I believe that the transition is going to last for a while. I don't think there is one business model. If anyone, a lot of people that know me know that I'm never in a kitchen, right? But I have this analogy of a stew that a lot of people are going to have to make up their own recipe for a business model. So I don't think that both, you know, sort of mainstream media is going to disappear or that of progressive or right-wing media. What we're going to see is this sort of big transition moment. And while we might not have daily newspapers in 30 years, there's still ways that people are going to be able to access media every day from a lot of different sources. The question is how media evolves to actually deliver that news to multiple communities.
And do you think we're in, as you mentioned, the transition, I think of the blogs when I go and try to look at different blogs, mm-hmm. and in a way trying to figure out which are the good ones and which are the ones where it's just somebody ranting and raving.
Yeah.
And sometimes ranting and raving can be funny,
sure.
But you're not necessarily getting information. How does one sort of filter through that to find out what's the most useful stuff?
Well, I mean, one of the major ways that people are doing it now is they're relying on their own network. They're relying on Twitter and Facebook and their friends and their family to help recommend stories and news. That's one way. There's also different other organizations that are trying to help with the filter failure, as I call it. There's groups like News Trust, where you work in tandem with other individuals to judge the credibility of different news stories. So there's lots of different ways. As more and more media outlets and opinions pop up, it's going to be required by more everyday citizens to have more media literacy. I mean, it's just the way it's going to go. But once again, if you rely on your network, as well as maybe people that maybe you don't always agree with, but they're people that recommending stories and you're recommending stories back to them as well, that's going to be a really healthy, exciting, dynamic way to really filter and understand media.
So as we come into our last minute, if people are listening to the show and they like Inside Government, your recommendation would be they should share that with their Facebook
Absolutely.
Friends, share it with Twitter, share it with their social media network?
Absolutely. I recommend that all media outlets not only ask but directly work with their audiences to suggest stories to send and how and so forth, because you really want to take advantage of your network because they love you. They want to help spread you, and you want to work with them to help do that.
And to find out more information on the Media Consortium, your website is?
TheMediaConsortium.org. And for the book, Beyond the Echo Chamber, it's beyondtheecho.net.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE Air Force Local 1101 President Dave Owens, Media Consortium Director Tracy Van Slyke, and Campaign for America's Future Fellow Dave Johnson. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. WFED.